My guest today is Mr. Dave Abbott, who's had a very long and illustrious career in broadcast. First of all, I'd like to ask you, how did you become interested in getting into radio?
I stumbled into radio through a total disaster in my life when I had a college in Spain for Canadians, which was on the island of Ibiza in the 1960s. I had been a housemaster at St. George's School for Boys in Vancouver, and I had left it to start this college in Spain. It collapsed through a whole series of dreadful stories that I won't bore you with, but the net result was I had to hurry back to Vancouver to explain to 25 couples why their daughter or son were no longer going to be educated in Spain and what had happened there. I got on the plane in Toronto, having visited a couple of families there, and explained why their son or their daughter was on their way back to them, and I'm sorry about the college and we'll get you a refund as soon as we can, but we have these problems with the authorities, Spanish authorities. And we made it anyway out of Toronto, and I'm on the plane and I have somebody beside me who says, "I know you." And I said, "I beg your pardon?" He said, "I know you." And I said, "Oh, really?" He said, "Yeah, I'm Pat Burns." And I said, "Yes." He said, "Well, you're David Abbott." And I said, "Yes." He said, "Well, I know who you are, and I've been talking about you." And I said, "You've been talking about me? What have you been saying about me?" He said, "You had all those rich kids in Spain with you, and it all blew up because your partner went gay, and you were stuck with them there on the rock." And I said, "That's only part of the story. And who are you again?" Anyway, he pulled out a copy of Maclean's magazine, and there he was on the front cover. Fast forward. Sitting beside him is Peter Kostick, the sales manager and general manager of CJOR, which at that time is hot, hot, hot with Burns, number one on the market. And he says to me, "You know something, you're an interesting kind of guy to do that thing in Spain. If you ever want to do radio, come and see me." 6 months later, I knocked on his door and I said, "I can't go back to education for at least another year, and I'm the talk of the town." And he said, "Right." He said, "We'll start you today. Arnie Nelson's down the hall. Go and see him. Peter Legg's over there and he'll help you out. And away you go. You're going into sales." I made sales calls for 3 months. Pat Burns got fired. Jack Wasserman walked in and said, when everybody's in a total panic, Peter Kostick got fired. John Donaldson takes over. He says, "What are we going to do? Burns is going up in flames. He's gone." Jack Wasserman said, "Put him on the air," pointing at me. I said, "Moi?" And Donaldson and everybody else, including Jerry Altman and so on, all said, "Abbott? On the air? What does he know? He's an Irishman." And Wasserman said, "Yes. And I heard him on St. Patrick's Day, and he'll be great. Put him on the air." And Dick Waters introduced me, and I went on the air, would you believe it, to substitute supposedly for Pat Burns, who had been fired, along with a lot of other people who had been let go. And so that was my career, such as it was, in radio, started in that sort of ignominious way. And I was launched into the marketplace, catapulted. Within 6 months, I got a phone call, and I was going crazy because I didn't, of course, the listeners for the Burns listeners were very angry at CJOR. I'm very angry at the CRTC because they'd taken away their man. So they were taking it out on anybody like myself or Vic Waters who were on the air. And it was really a beating. But came around Christmas time, or shortly after Christmas, or before Christmas, I got a phone call. "Bill Hughes here, Dave." Well, now, I'd never met Bill Hughes, but the legend was already renowned. I said, "Mr. Hughes, yes. Yes, sir, what can I do for you?" He said, "I'd like to talk with you." He said, "Can we get together over Christmas and have a chat?" He said, "I'm looking just to expand what we have at CKNW.
What year would that be?
That would have been 65. Mm-hmm. So that's where I started. He said, "Here's your program on CKNW. You're going to be between Webster and Jack Cullen." Oh, dear, what a dreadful place to be. I mean, really, it was just marvelous. I spend the day with Webster and then I hand over to Jack Cullen. I mean, it's like handing over to history, you know.
When you were doing a talk show?
I was doing a talk show. I started when Webster finished City Mike on at night at 6:30. I came on the air at 7, and I was on then till 9. And then Jack Cullen took over at 9 o'clock to midnight. So I was on for that two-hour slot in there. And then when Webster was away, I would fill in for Webster in the morning as well as City Mike.
Now, where were their studios at that time?
We moved down to, the studios were plush and very, very sexy, very quiet, very remote, very isolated in the sense they were on the mezzanine floor of the Hotel Georgia, right in the heart of the city. And there were double doors to get in, and you wouldn't know looking at it outside. It merely said CKNW, very in small letters. And we were in there, and you could only get in with our buzzers to let you through. So Webster and myself were there, and we would have our guests in there. And of course, the Cave, Izzy's, all the nightclubs were going. The city was a buzz at night. Wasserman was still buzzing around the place. And we had every major, as you know, act in the entire North American room.
So these people would be guests on your show?
Absolutely.
They'd just walk in the door and away
you go. You literally would be told that Sinatra's coming to town. I'm sure you'd like to talk with them. Yes, I would, of course. Well, we'll see what we can arrange. And so off we go. Because it was all to feed, of course, the people to get into the Cave or whatever. So I had some memorable moments with people like Jane Mansfield, who will live forever in my mind, you know, because of getting to there. And others who were very nasty and very ugly and very difficult. But the bigger they were, the nicer they were. That's really after all those years. And a lot of the interviews I did, literally hundreds of them, were in the main people who were tolerant and allowed me to grow into the business, really, because it was all sort of fairly new to me and totally new.
How long did you stay in that position?
I stayed there with CKNW for about 6 years. Mm-hmm. And then I left, much to their astonishment, and I think my own to some degree, because my wife and I were starting to separate, and it just was difficult to hold on to the marriage. And I thought if I left with her and got out of town and got away from the business for a year or two, we might be able to hold ourselves together. So I did that. I resigned from CKNW. Bill Hughes was very upset. Hal Davis was the PD at the time, and what a lovely man he was. Mm-hmm. I wish they were more of those men around today. I'm a man a little older than they, but at that time. But they had a sense of values and worth and appreciation of talent, and were ready to grow it and develop it and so on.
And now it's totally different.
I think it's totally different because there's really few professionals like Bill Hughes and Davis and so Hal Davis and people like him who really love the business, as you obviously do, clearly do. And I certainly do. I love radio. Anyway, that was the beginning of my career in radio. And it was through the Pat Burns College in Spain collapse, and here I am today. And it really was that weird, if you like, Mike.
And after you left CKNW, what was
went to Brentwood College over in Vancouver Island. Was in Brentwood College, which was a private boarding school for boys, and I was one of the senior masters there, and so on. And then the Clarion call came. Would I like to come and do television over in Vancouver for a night or two for the politicians, their interviews? Yes, I would. So I'd fly over from Mill Bay and I'd do my interviews and stuff. And then would I come and join the advisory council on sports and recreation? Oh, yes, I'd love to do that too. So I started getting these invitations, which was taking me out of the Brentwood College loop. And that's a society within society. And eventually I got the call from Victoria. We would love you to come and join CJVI, and we'll pay you 2-3 times what you're making now. And it's just down the street, and you know the island, and you're on the island, and we'd love you to take over the morning, and we're going to be CFAX.
Okay. And where was that located?
That was CJVI, right downtown on 4th Street in Victoria. And I used to come out at lunchtime, and I tell you, it was getting, after a few years, it got a bit heavy because there was nobody under the age of 80 on the street except me. And I thought it was kind of an old audience, if you like, a dying breed and an interesting breed and fascinating people and lovely people, But they were very, very on in years, beyond my years anyway. So there I was at CJVI, and I became number one in CJVI in Victoria, and I wrote to Wasserman.
Now, the program you were doing on
CJVI, Talk Show, I was doing 8:30 in the morning to 12 noon every day. And I got involved in the local mayor's politics and the provincial politics. And I had great fun with W.A.C. Bennett and all his cabinet ministers. And I could just scrape the bottom of their feet, you know, every day, every morning with somebody or other, and have a lot of reaction. So, because you had a mixture of NDP and liberals and conservatives and social creditors all together. And here, and CJVI was 900 on the dial, very powerful, reached out. And anyway, we got a nice big audience out of it. So I was happy with that. And then I got a call from Wasserman. I wrote to Wasserman and said, well, now I'm number one. Thanks very much, Jack, you know. Now what? And the next thing is I'm getting a call. CJOR would love to have a chat with you. We're looking for maybe to add you to the roster. So Vancouver called. So back to Vancouver I come to CJOR. And that's where I went for, you know, the next few years. And that was an interesting period of my life. It was a time when they didn't know where they were at. And they kept asking me to do sex shows. And I kept saying, no, I'm not doing sex shows. Now, by sex shows, I mean shows that had been on the air in Los Angeles, taking phone calls from supposedly milkmen who were delivering more than milk, and from other sort of dalliances that housewives had in Los Angeles, and were phoning this radio station to talk about it and brag about it and so on. And they wanted me to do that. And I said no. And then they wanted me to do a sort of a Dear Abby, but of a sexual nature. And I said, no. And they were getting very angry with me. And I was being very difficult and very stubborn. And they asked everybody in town to come and do a talk show like this. And the only one that agreed, believe it or not, was Denny Boyd, the Sun columnist and a bloody fine writer. But he had his problems. And however, sensing some excitement in his life, said okay. So he'd come to do the talk show, and I was fired, and I was out the door. And there was Denny Boyd in 6 months nearly died of an ulcer and totally collapsed on the air and was taken off the air after 6 months and never seen in radio ever again.
What year would we be at now?
I guess this would be in the early 80s.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, somewhere in there, in the 82s, 83s, somewhere like that.
So what was the next step?
Well, the next step was I was out on my ear, and I was standing there sort of with my mouth open saying, what happened? Well, that's what happened. You didn't do what they wanted you to do. And of course, it didn't last. The sex talk, I mean, not only did Denny nearly die as a result of it, but also the radio station nearly died because of it. It just didn't. There was no sustaining that in this market. Then, or probably even now, I don't know. But anyway, nobody's doing it right now. So I went into my own production company. I got a place down on Water Street, 68 Water Street, which I totally renovated from top to bottom. It was a five-story building. And I put in my own offices on three of the floors, mm-hmm. rented out the other two, and spent far too much money doing it, but had a lot of fun, and it was looked really dramatic and great. And I ran that as an ad agency, as a public relations, a guy called Fred Hill, who might be known to some of the listeners as the star and the leading man of the Drunkard, a play that was around here before my time. But in the 19... Fred Hill was the Drunkard in the 40s and 50s.
Hmm.
I hired Fred as my public relations guy because he was brilliant in a very off-center way. And I had an ad agency as well, and one of my major clients was Jack Poole of Dayon, the late Jack Poole, the head of the president of VanOck of the Olympic Games, who died tragically of cancer just before the games. And Jack and I ran Dayon's advertising as one of my clients. I had the Satchel Shops and many others, and I had
Renault.
Were you
writing and producing?
I was writing, producing, I was directing. I had a staff eventually of 32, and we were very successful, yeah. And we had a production house on the fourth floor. And the third floor, we had advertising agency. Fourth floor, we had a production house, a full production house. full audiovisual house. And yeah. And then I eventually rented upstairs number 5 as well. So I continued with that for quite some time, and I had a dreadful divorce, and very painful, very expensive. So my next thing to do was to go to Africa. So I took off to Africa. And before I went to Africa, I phoned CBC and I said, I will be in Africa. I will be here and here and here, and I will be 1 or 2 years or more, and I'm willing to do. I'd done work for CBC Radio and some television, including this Hour of 7 Days, when Webster was involved and I was brought into that loop, and with Patrick Watson and Laurier Lapierre and all those days. But that was sort of a part-time fleeting thing. So, but they were. I was known to them, and I had done a lot of radio, with the help of a friend of mine called Diana Filer, who took a fancy to me, and she had done a lot of development work out of Vancouver and then eventually Toronto, where she became vice president. And she liked what I did. So she, so I said, I'm going to Africa. And so I was a correspondent for CBC Radio for, 5 years, 6 years. I used to supply programs right across the board of a cultural nature about Africa, both political and social and musical, and intellectual or academia, whatever it was. And I'd come across a nice story, I'd feed it down the line to whoever my producer was for that area in Toronto.
Right.
And I had great fun doing that. And then I joined Thompson's Newspapers as managing editor of a group of magazines and newspapers in Johannesburg. And Thompson's is the same Thompson's in Canada, but it was Thompson's Africa. And I took over there then, and still did the work for CBC, but it was very hit and miss, so it was very precarious way to live. So, but when I became ME of Thompson's Africa, that was great. I also had a column I wrote every week and so on. So I enjoyed that immensely. And then the call came to develop and go out on my own. I did that in Africa for 5 years as a sort of a primary, as an agency, feeding TV, feeding video.
A
production company.
Right.
And I did that. And then I heard Expo was coming to Vancouver. And Patrick Reed was coming to Vancouver, or was in Vancouver as the Commissioner General, who was a good Irishman. So I thought, well, I'm coming home. I'm very tired. I've been away from British Columbia. I love Vancouver so much, in British Columbia and Canada. I don't belong in Africa. I loved Africa, and it was fascinating. I did a lot of freelance work. I did work for SABC while I was there through a friend of mine who happened to be well-connected. So the South African Broadcasting Corporation would bring me in occasionally. But I had to be careful with what I said on the air, because these were apartheid days.
Yes.
And I was not exactly in tune with the thinking of the government at the time, at any time. So I tended to be a bit more rebellious, and I would actually meet with the blacks in Soweto illegally, but I did it, and then I'd feed it back to CBC in Toronto. So it was great. My sister used to smuggle me in with my tape recorder, and I would knock quietly on the side door and be allowed into this inner sanctum of some of the people who had been stirring the revolution out in Soweto, and I would be given an interview. And I recall interviewing, sort of in hush-hush terms, while the police were patrolling the area looking for white boys who should not be there, of course.
Were you frightened while you were doing this at all?
I was frightened in the sense that I was aware that I was in trouble, and I had to be alert, but there was not much I could do if they came for me. There's no sort of, I can mix with the crowd, they won't notice me. You know, I wasn't exactly invisible.
So after coming back from Africa, what was next?
I actually, my daughter by then, Ingrid Abbott, had progressed to working at CJOR.
Again. Call letters keep coming up.
Yes, and she'd been at CBC and so on, and now she came back and she went, and she'd be CBC in Quebec, in Montreal. And then she came back with her husband and our daughter, and she got to work at CJOR. And I said to her, oh, that's nice, Ingrid, we're back at Dad's old station. She said, well, you knew that. And I said, yes, of course I did. And she said, Frank Callahan wants to see you. I said, really? How lovely. So I said, okay. So I went down, and who was on the air doing the talk show on CJOR, Dave Barrett, a guy who I played rugby with and I knew had been in politics at one time or another and had done some supposedly major things. I'm not sure. Anyway, so David, as you gather, our politics were not exactly the same. But so I said to Frank Callahan, what's what? He said, we want you to join us. And I said, CJOR, oh my goodness, where, what time, you know, what do you want me to do, whereabouts? And he said, no, I want you to join the morning show with Barrett. The ratings are not what they should be. We don't believe that he's as bad as they indicate, and he can be a lot better if he needs some help, because he's never done this before. So we want you to go in as a sort of sidekick, you know, so it's the Dave Barrett with Dave Abbott, you know, the George Garrett of CJOR. Well, this is the thinking. Mm-hmm. And I guess it wasn't bad thinking at the time. But at the time, anyway. So I went in to, and I said, listen, the amount of money they were paying me was frankly, it was serious money. Mm-hmm. So I was delighted to do it, of course. And I just got off the boat from Africa. And my daughter was there. And, so I quickly established myself and sort of helped David out. I did keep running into problems with him when I'd come up with a story that he didn't particularly want aired or talked about. He was quite censorious in that sense, you know, I don't want to talk about that. I'm not associated with that. That's not my story, that's your story. I don't think it belongs on my program. So I was in one of those dilemmas, you know, and I remember coming up with the story about, a pedophile who I'd gone in search of and his tracks all the way down to the States. And he had been transporting little boys and girls across Canada for the pleasure of very well-to-do, very well-connected people. I happened to get a list of them, and I set off on my journey down into St. George, Utah, and Las Vegas, and God knows where. It took me down to Long Beach. I was down in San Diego. I was all over the place, and I interviewed all the heads of the crime squads who look after pedophilia. Anyway, I went on the air, and I announced all of this, but before I did, Barrett, when he knew what I was doing, said, I'm not here. I'm getting out of the studio now. I wanted to be on record that I was not present when this took place. I want to make sure everybody knows I am not associated with this broadcast. I said, David, it's all right. I've checked it with the lawyers, everything I'm going to say, all my tapes, all my interviews, and the boys and the girls and the pedophilia and what's going on. I said, it's a perfectly legitimate comment on my part, and here it is, substantiated with the following information. No, I have nothing to do with this. I'm leaving now. And out the studio he went, and then I carried on. Well, it was shortly after that. It was shortly after that Dave Barrett actually resigned from CJOR doing a talk show, having actually done extremely well financially. I think Jimmy paid him about $150,000.
A lot of money.
I mean, when we're talking now about the 80s, mm-hmm. And you know, for doing literally 3 hours a day on the air, in which he really didn't bother his Barney. He just sort of sat there and chatted. And because he had put no energy into it, he didn't get anything back from it. And so he just sat there in a sweater, chatting away like he would if you and I were sitting around our living room. So that's why it wasn't working. Nothing to do with his lack of knowledge, which was extensive. But he just didn't want to engage with people. He was bored. Mm. But he didn't, you know, he was bored that to the tune of whatever.
And you really need a talent to pull this off.
You need to be weird, I think, now. Now that I look back, Michael, I think you need to be a performer, I guess, number one. Mm-hmm. And you need to be garrulous. You need to be articulate. You need to be able to roll with it a little. And it's a strange beast, a 3-hour talk show every day. I remember so many people, as I'm sure you've come across it, would say to you, is that all you do? God, that's easy. You just sit there and talk.
They don't think about the research that goes on in the background, all of the extra work that's done. Hate it.
Sure. And then to dress it up and present it in such a way that people wanted to listen to it, day in and day out, and become hooked on the manner in which you address them or whatever. Or their believability that you had. Yeah, so that was,
How long did that go on?
Yes, in the 80s. I've been to Africa, I've come back, and I was...
Been on CJOR.
I was on CJOR, and I stayed there until... I went back to NW. I went back to NW.
And what was the job but NW?
They wanted me in to do the talk show in the afternoon. And they were anticipating moving Bill up into the morning, and I would move into the afternoon. That didn't happen, as you know. But yeah, so I said, yeah, I'll do that, sure. Not a problem. So I did. But yes.
And then they moved to...
TD, yeah, the building down right in the heart of the city.
So how long did you stay doing that, the talk show in the afternoon?
Well, I stayed doing that for about three years or more, somewhere in there. And then I got a call saying, oh dear, it's so easy to, I can remember it well. I got a call saying, would I like to come over and join CKVU? Because there was a television opening. Laurier LaPierre was leaving. Mm-hmm. He was moving on. I mean, later he became a senator, as you know. He's a senator today. And so would I be interested in taking over the television time slot? I thought, wow, I'll do the NW thing. That's okay. And I can do TV in the morning.
As well, yeah.
As well. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's not quite what NW had in mind. Because the guy who was doing the morning show then was Rafe Mayer. And Rafe Mayer was doing the morning show. And he said, Abbott on television up against me? No way. I didn't know this. But it was a sort of an ultimatum. Either you get rid of him and not stop him doing that, or I walk. Well, they couldn't do that. So they said, okay, well, we'll get rid of him. So I sat down and I said, what do you mean I can't work at CK? You can't have the TV show and you cannot have the radio show. It's one or the other. Now choose. And I said, Ron, choose. What? Because you just cannot have the radio and TV personalities, you and Rafe, head on in the morning. So I said, goodbye. And I went to CKVU to do the morning, the television morning talk show. Sandwiched between Oprah and Phil Donahue.
Well, that's not a bad bookend.
Not bad bookends at all, no. In fact, I was very flattered. The trouble was that it begs comparison when you switch from one to the other. And after you've done Phil Donahue, and now they have who? Oh, this guy that was used to be on radio. Is that him? Who's he got? He's got the mayor of Coquitlam on with him. No kidding. Hey, after Frank Sinatra, that's such a refreshing change. And so there you are. Here I am, stuck with the mayor of Coquitlam. And Oprah's going to bring you, you know, God, dressed up as the Virgin Mary. And I'm left with the vice mayor of Port Moody. So it didn't have the appeal. The production values weren't there. It was tough, that's all. And I stuck it out. But it was really... And the amazing thing about it, Michael, is that television seems to be effortless when you view it. And I'm not talking about the host, because I wasn't really ill at ease in any way as a host. In fact, had no trouble with the cameras. But I didn't realize how many people are involved in the production of a one-hour program.
It's amazing.
It's amazing. I called out one day, very early in, when I joined CKVU, which is now, of course, part of Global, which is now part of Shaw, which is, God knows where it'll be in the universe by the time this is broadcast anywhere.
Or if you're even watching TV anymore.
Yeah, right, exactly, yes. But it was interesting. $700,000 a year was what they had budgeted for my program. And that was not enough, because you didn't have more than two cameras. You know, if I wanted three cameras, I had to beg. And, and so on and so on. So it's an expensive proposition. Anyway, there I was, out of CKNW, into the deep end of CKVU, and just hanging on to my broadcasting sanity in that place. And then I left it. And what did I do then?
Okay, where are we now? What
I've left CKVU.
Are we in the 90s? Yeah. In the 90s now?
Yeah, we're into the 90s. Okay. Yes, yes. Oh, yes. I had my own company, actually. I went back to my communications company. I'm fairly certain I did. I started to do major events. I did the Dragon Boat Festival. I created the Dragon Boat Festival, for example, with Milton Wong. That was one of my babies. Mm-hmm. Nothing to do necessarily with broadcasting, but while I was at CKNW, I was sort of got involved in the Chinese-Canadian community, And that's what came out of that, was the Dragon Boat Festival.
That's where it says you went to AM 1040. Vice President of Public Affairs and host producer of Asia
Pacific
Diary.
Oh, I did indeed.
Diary.
Yes, I did.
So that must be the right time.
That's right, it was. And I went in, I tell you what, I had taught for a while, for 4 years at St. George's as a housemaster. The head of 1040 at the time of the radio station, which was on its knees, was Brian Brann, who is currently, I think, at
News
Rogers. Yeah. And so Brian was there, and I went to see him, and I said, I'm back in town, and could you use me? And he said, oh, yes, I can use you. So he said, let me pull you in, and we'll put you on the air doing a talk show in the morning. Well, I mean, Rafe was still on the air at NW, and I'd been gone, and, you know, and here I was back again doing a talk show. And of course,
trying to battle the beast.
Oh, the NW beast,
yes.
I mean, which is just an enormous thing. So anyway, I had a lot of fun with it, and he was very annoyed. And I would steal guests, or he would steal guests, and we would back and forth from NW to AM 1040. And AM 1040 hadn't much money at all, but a man called Ron Dixon had bought it for less than $1 million, I believe. Yeah, I think so. And, you know, it used to belong to Don Hamilton, and so he had sold it. And then it had gone through metamorphoses of all kinds until Dixon bought it. And we thought we were home free with that. We did quite well. We got a rating of 5 in our first book, which I thought was quite good. Anyway, that started to disintegrate when he moved. He moved the station then to a building he owned over into downtown Vancouver. And, and he took over the ground floor, and that became AM 1040 there. And we did quite well for quite a while, for a number of years. But Dixon was a very odd, strange man. The late Mr. Ronald Dixon, I don't know if you are familiar with him, but it was his one and only entry into broadcast, and I don't think he was necessarily auspicious. John Reynolds, the MP, one-time Speaker of the House, in was the one who put Dixon onto the station being available to buy for a song and a dance, really. And we would provide both the song and the dance, and he would provide very little music to go with it, I can tell you. A few dollars, but he got it anyway, and he ran it into the ground. It was a very strange behaviour that he exhibited. And he brought his ex-wife in to run the operation, who was an Australian lady who'd never been inside a radio station in her life. And he gave instructions to my daughter, Ingrid, who was the head of the talk shows that were going on at the time. Charlie McLean, the late Charles McLean, was one of the talkers. And Downtown Judy Brown was another one of them that we had. And I did the morning show, that is to say, 9 to noon. And anyway, he just had the strangest way of dealing with people, and he would fire and hire people without letting anybody know. I was the director of the company, and I had shares in it, but I had no real say. And anyway, he went to Mexico and died. Now the radio station has no owner. And the wife is totally incapable of running it, and his daughter wouldn't talk to him or us. So the station ended up being taken over by his accountant, who runs it to this day. But then they sold it to become a sports station, right?
Yes, so part of the CTV group.
Right, so that's where they sold it. I think they only got about 600,000 or something like that for it. I would think so. Maybe not. It certainly wouldn't be worth much more than that. So now I was out of radio, that radio anyway. Meanwhile, I'd done other television and radio things, of course, documentaries and stuff with the CBC. I ran a talk show on CBS on KVOS out of Bellingham for a few years. That was a gig that I really enjoyed that Webster gave me. And that's when I ran into troubles with them down in the States in Bellingham, where they were broadcasting, still do, KVOS. And I really had I had a half hour every Sunday night, just before or after 60 Minutes, which was great. It was a wonderful audience to have. So I had to have some pretty sharp people, which I did, and on the program, until the day that I was doing Runaways in British Columbia and Victoria and Vancouver. And I thought, well, it'd be a great program to have the head of the Georgia Strait with me, the newspaper, And I'd also have Fred Latrimo, who at that time was on CFON under, or CKLG, I think.
CKLG.
Yeah. And so Fred Latrimo, who was a good-looking guy and an outspoken and contributed to the Georgia Strait, and Dan McLeod. So we went down and we started to talk about the Runaways and the way the Georgia Strait had written it up and what did Fred know about it and so on, and what was his interest. But little did I know that they were right out of it. They were so stoned that I couldn't tell until Fred decided halfway through the TV show to catch imaginary flies. And I might tell you, after a few of this went on, and I was really beginning, and the cameramen, two cameramen, were just shaking their head, and they couldn't even turn the cameras on them. And then McLeod, so they were fascinated between Fred and Dan McLeod. So it says, don't bother me, I'm not of this world. I'm off having myself a great time out there in the sky. And here was Fred acting like that. So it was a very embarrassed Abbott who had to finish off the program. And then the general manager and vice president came out and he was white with rage. And that was the end of my KVOS television career after 2.5 years. Thank you very much. Yes, so and there you go.
That was the end of full-time radio and television, or whatever?
Yes. Yeah, well, until I was having dinner recently, he said, 8 years ago, I was having dinner at High's Encore with my wife, and we were just enjoying the evening, and it was lovely, and I see this figure waving for me, and I look, and it's Jimmy Patterson. And I said, hello, Jimmy, how are you? And he said, I haven't seen you. He said, you've been away. I said, that's right, on your back. Yeah, what are you doing? I said, well, I'm doing this and thinking of doing that. And I'm there. He said, why aren't you working for me? And I said, working for you? I said, as far as I know, there's no opportunities there, that station, for me at 600. And he said, why not? And I said, I really don't know the people involved. I know Rick Honey was there, but, you know. And he said, well, there's somebody there. He said, I can't remember his name, but he's the program director. You write him a letter and send me a copy about what you want to do.
So you were
he was talking about Gordon
Eno.
Eno. Mm. Gordon Eno. And he couldn't remember the name. I don't know. So anyway, I did. And Jimmy stamped it, rubber stamped it. And I walked in to Hornet's Nest, in a sense, because they were sort of saying, who is this guy and what is he doing here? And he's just been imposed on us from on high, from the boss. And that's never a comfortable feeling.
No.
However, I tried to make myself clear that I wasn't going to take over the station. I didn't want their job. And I wasn't a threat in any way to where they were headed. In fact, I might help them out. So I started then a 7-year run of my programs on travel around the world.
I remember those very well.
Ah, thank you. Good. Yeah, and then I was at the same time lecturing on various nations that had countries I'd visited and spent time in on Holland America ships, who paid handsomely and then flew me business class wherever the ship was, and I would cruise and then fly back. And I did that for 14 years. So it was really lovely doing that. And my travel thing, and then I syndicated in 52 newspapers, and I've added a few more now, and a few websites that I write for as well, and the Independent Times, which I'm just delighted to write for. So we have, it's life is good.
We can't say you're retired.
I don't think.
Maybe semi-retired.
Semi-retired, whatever. You know what?
Work when you want to.
That's right. I'm involved in Choice Communications, which is a Canadian-Chinese communications company based in Hong Kong and Beijing and Vancouver, and I'm a director of business development for them, and we've just embarked on a new program which involves property development but also cultural development of Chinese coming into Canada. So yes, I'm still involved, but not, and radio is magic. I remember Jack Moore, who may some of your listeners may recall, was a very good writer for the Courier and so on around town, and went to Hong Kong for many years. And Jack used to wrote a lovely piece about radio where he said, I walked into the studio, he'd been interviewing me, or was about to, and he came in and he said, and I sat in this room where a piece of wire hung from the ceiling, and when you spoke, it carried your words, for 100,000 watts in every direction. and all you had to do was talk to a wire and it carried your voice. You know, that stayed with me. That's all it really is a wire, isn't it?
It certainly is. Yeah. A couple of questions that I have to ask everybody.
Absolutely.
Favorite people that you've worked with?
Webster. Not always pleasant, but without question, the number one person that I in my life, in broadcast life, absolutely. I'd rank a couple of people up there with that. Hal Davis was Bill Hughes. Hughes and Davis, lovely couple of guys. Good man.
Oh, those are good. Top three.
Yeah. I mean, Jerry Altman was always somebody I was very fond of in the business because he was honorable. Arnie Nelson, who's now late, Arnie Nelson, who's now unfortunately left us, was a very helpful, honorable man too. Yeah, there were a lot of, Vic Waters was great. There were some, Red Robinson was wonderful. I used to have Red on every now and then, and he was always on the go doing something different. And I'd have him on CKNW and unabashedly. And, you know, some would go, tut, 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 you can't do that, he's with another radio station. And I'd say, nonsense. You know, Johnny Carson doesn't say, oh, well, this show is going to be on, I can't tell you the station. Yeah, I said, this is silly, you know. So I used to have Red on. And, of course, I was dealing with people like, on either side, here was Webster and there was Cullen. My goodness, Cullen. Cullen, the first time I met Jack, said, you haven't met Cullen? Go down tonight and say hello to Cullen. So I went down to Cullen's, up into this dingy, dark studio on the top of a three-story building. And there was Cullen, crouched behind a lamp, talking away into the microphone, surrounded by every piece of conceivable piece of music and records and books and memorabilia of all kinds, every sort of garbage, a lot of it, and bottles of booze, and a big drink in front of him. And so I introduced myself during the commercial, or during the music break, and he said, here. And he said, I have a guest in the studio who's just walked in, a young man who's going to be big in radio. Here, read this, kid. And he passes me over a script this long from Army and Navy for stockings and stuff and see it to read. Now, he said, go on, read it. So I'm reading the commercial on NW with Cullen. And of course, it's all to do with stockings and Dernier and else. I hadn't even seen it before. And I'm scratching my brains trying to get it out. Cullen's having a roaring old time, drunk as a lord, and delighted. So that was my introduction to the great man himself, yeah.
To end this on a high note, what was your very favorite memory of your long career? What was your favorite thing?
Well, gosh, there's so many of them that come to mind. I guess one of the most dramatic was spending the weekend while Ferdinand Marcos and his wife Imelda were in exile in Hawaii, and I spent the weekend with them in their house interviewing them and taping them, which I used on CJOR and on CBC television. That was very, very good. Li Ka-shing, who developed the Expo Lands, I was the only person ever granted a TV interview with him, which I obtained through the graces of a very prominent lady in our society. And that was unusual. So Li Ka-shing was certainly a standout in my mind. I guess locally, the Eric Martin Institute, which we now know exists, was close not to coming into being because of behavior by Eric Martin. But those were the highlights. Certainly the international events were Bishop Tutu, just wonderful to meet Mandela, you know, to know. And to know Winnie, but not like her. I mean, I watched while she set the children on fire, you know, with their neck lacing. So you see those things. I covered quite a number of wars, which were scary and exhilarating. So it was kind of interesting to do it all, you know, the Vietnam and then I did down in the Caribbean as well. I was there and I was in Ulster a few times. And yeah, so, and then in Africa, it was at times there were scary moments when that happened.
You've had a brilliant and an amazing career and a very long one.
I've been very lucky, like yourself, Michael. I've been very, very fortunate. And the business is tough, is hard. And I don't mean doing the work, just hanging on, though, to exercise your talents or whatever, or your independence anyway, because you can be subjected to the accounting mind, which is not quite creative in many ways.
One last question before we go. Do you listen to any radio at all now?
Oh, yes, I do, indeed. I listen across the board. I go from 650 through to CKNW, of course. I listen to the FM stations as well. In the States, I love National Public Radio. I think it's NPR is great. I listen to a fair amount of CBC, both AM and FM. Mostly FM, I think, I listen to. But yeah, I know I listen to them all, the locals as well. And I like the girl on the woman, I forget her name straight off, in the afternoon on NW. I think she's doing a great job. She used to be...
That'd be Christy Clark.
Christy Clark, a minister, wasn't she, in the Campbell mm-hmm. government. And she's very good. She's the brightest thing on that station. The men are dreadful. They should listen to her and they could learn from her. They really could. She's got a lot of personality that comes across. It's lovely.
Dave Abbott.
Thank you.
Thank you very
Michael,
much for the
thanks
time.
Thanks very much. I'm delighted to do it. I hope it was interesting.